hadn't merely used the house as an observation platform, but had taken shelter there. Perhaps with the mass murderer, Abdullah al-Ghazali. Pax and his guys wouldn't move against the house until full daylight. And even then, they would wait as long as the situation supported a delay, hoping for some indication that the smoker wasn't the sole occupant. If the seven terrorists were spread out in, say, three widely separated houses, an attack on one would alert those quartered in the other two, and the element of surprise would be lost. In that event, the odds of nailing al-Ghazali himself weren't as good as they ought to be. Regardless, the assault would occur during the coming day. A further delay was too risky. From somewhere in the waning night came the eerie cry of that desert wildcat called a caracal, and Paxton tensed. Chapter 36, Scrabblemancy. Crazy as it was, with the pierced thumb and the blood and the tiger-eyed blonde Amazon, with candle wicks popping and hissing, with salamanders of candlelight chasing their own lithe shadows across the tabletop, with the fragrance of roses rising with ever greater and somehow funereal intensity from the next room, and with the threat of unknown enemies gathering in the night to home in on psychic waves that Bibi could in no way detect, she nonetheless found her disbelief suspended. For the moment, Kalida Butterfly had a presence, an air of authority, that would make the most committed skeptic doubt his own doubt. The diviner stirred her right hand through the wood tiles that filled the silver bowl, neither watching to see what letters her fingers plucked from that alphabet soup, nor trying to discern them by a braille reader's touch.
"I command the secret knowledge regarding Bibi's cancer cure," she said, her husky yet musical voice conveying an intolerance for resistance from whatever occult power she meant to interrogate. "I bleed for answers. I can't be denied. Attend me. Why was Bibi Blair spared from gliomatosis cerebri?"
She dropped four tiles upon the table, and they clicked like dice, and then two more, and three, and a final two. Some tiles were face down, and she turned them over. She arranged them from A to V, and had this: A, A, E, E, F, I, L, O, S, T, V. She lined them up on the table so that if she turned to her left and Bibi to her right, both could read them. From 11 letters, even if there were duplicates, many words could be formed. Although Bibi made no move to organize the tiles, she saw leave, leaf, fast, feast, soft, solve, float, soul. Kalida fingered four letters out of the lineup. Evil, which didn't improve Bibi's mood.
"We must use all 11 of them to find the true message," the diviner explained.
First, she spelled out, "A fate so evil," and studied it for a moment, but then said,
"No, that's not an answer. At most, it's a half-assed threat."
"Threat? Who's threatening you? Or is it me being threatened?" Rather than answer either question, Kalida rearranged some of the letters to spell East Evil Oaf.
"Off to a false start," she said. "Evil isn't the key word."
A quiet but growing urgency in Kalida's manner, a puzzling, continued intensification of the fragrance of roses until an odor of floral rot seemed to underlie their perfume, a quickening of the pulse and flitter of the many candle flames so that the table swam with silverfish of light and phantom moths beat their soundless, insubstantial wings against the walls. Bibi began to feel that she was slowly, then more rapidly, succumbing to a fever, not born of physical illness. A fever of unreason, as dangerous as any infection. On the table, foil a tease made no sense, and it left one letter unused. Via least foe was likewise without clear meaning. Suddenly Bibi saw what the diviner did not, and reached out to spell, to save a life.
That's it, Kalida loudly declared, with no slightest note of uncertainty. Kid, you're a natural for this, intuitive. The client never sees the message. They sit like toads, waiting for me to feed them flies.
Bibi said, let me get this straight. So I was spared from cancer to save my life. I sort of already knew that.
No, girl, that's not what it says. You can read the words, but I can read the words and their intended meaning. You were spared from cancer so that you could save the life of someone else.
Bibi didn't at once buy into that interpretation. Save from what? When? Where? Why? She wasn't an adventurer, not a superhero. She hated tights and capes. Not a woman of action unless the action was on the written page. Who? She asked. Save who?
That's what we ask next.
Not quite ready to pose the question, the diviner picked up her glass and quickly swallowed the remaining wine. Bibi realized now that the Chardonnay was either to help Kalida cope with the pain of the needle piercing her thumb, or to boost her courage, or perhaps both. Stirring her right hand in the silver bowl full of tiles, the diviner said,
I bleed for answers. I can't be...
Before the woman could finish, Bibi's smartphone, lying on the table, issued a call tone that imitated the antique ring of a rotary dial telephone. She glanced at the screen and said, there's no caller ID, ignore it. Failure to take the call clearly alarmed Kalida.
No, if you don't answer it, we won't know if it's them.
Them, who?
The wrong people.
Her candle glitter stare no longer seemed to be that of a diviner confident that she had her foot on the throat of whatever supernatural entity she had been consulting.
Answer it. For God's sake.
Further disquieted, Bibi took the call. Hello? A man said.
Top agent.
Huh? Who is this?
What does that mean, top agent?
I don't know what you're talking about.
Why play dumb? It's the license plate on your car.
Oh. Not my car, my mother's. Who is this? The caller hung up. Some guy, Bibi told Kalida. I drove Mom's car home. He wants to know what the vanity plate means. Kalida's worried frown folded some of the youth out of her face.
Doesn't sound like one of them.
Whether it's one of them or not, he must have seen me when I drove home. Or he's in the parking lot right now. Everything's sort of sliding, isn't it?
Sliding? What do you mean?
Downhill. Over the edge. Into chaos, Bibi said. And wondered why her usual self-possession seemed to be failing her. Well, she hadn't prepared herself for a world with these sudden new and strange dimensions. She had prepared herself to write stories for the Antioch Review, for Granta, for Prairie Schooner, to publish a first novel with Random House. She didn't possess the emotional and psychological flexibility to deal easily with sudden, inexplicable cancer cures and the supernatural consequences that followed them. Kalida looked at her oddly.
Everything is always sliding. Life is an avalanche, kid. And you know that as well as I do. Sometimes a slow and more enjoyable kind of sliding. Sometimes wild. I read your novel. It's in there, The Avalanche. Get your skis on, girl, and ride the snow wave. Don't let it wipe you out.
Yeah, well, right now I feel like a spleet.
A what?
A goob, a wanker, a Wilma. She picked up her half-full glass,
She pulled a Kalida and finished the Chardonnay in one long swallow.
"To save a life,"
the diviner said, reading the tiles on the table.
"Now, let's find out whose."
Chapter 37. Every mama's baby's got to pee. The shriek of the caracal in the night had worried Pax, because he thought it might be the work of a mimic. When two shrieks followed and seemed to originate in a far different place from the first, his concern increased. If he and his guys were known to be in town, maybe they were being stalked by agents of some local warlord, signaling readiness to one another in the language of caracals. There were caracals in the Middle East, though their numbers were much lower than in Africa and Asia. Iranians had once trained those cats to hunt birds. Although caracals weighed as much as 40 pounds, they could leap straight up as high as 7 or 8 feet, biting and battering down 8 or 10 birds at once from a low-flying flock. Pax and Danny had stood ready, awaiting another cat cry to judge its authenticity. MK-12s in hand, wishing the guns pumped out a more damaging caliber. Yet time had passed, and the dawn had come without incident. Sometimes a caracal was nothing more than a caracal. As the first hours of light brought no wind, only a deepening quiet, Paxton hoped for some telltale to confirm that more than one of the terrorists resided in the shuttered house. At 8:47, his satellite phone vibrated. Perry called from his position, with Gibb, on the roof of a two-story building east of the target house. He spoke in hardly more than a murmur.
"One male, not the smoker. Backyard. 2 buckets.
Say again. Buckets?
Carrying buckets."
After a pause, Perry said,
"Back gate. Into the street. Moving south."
"Weapon?"
Paxton asked.
"Drop leg holster."
If the terrorist hadn't been armed, and if he had ventured far enough from the target house, they might have tried to capture him for interrogation. But one shot would alert the other bad guys, and if intel was correct, bad girls.
"Probably night soil,"
Perry said. He was a fan of historical fiction, especially novels of war and seafaring set in the 18th century. Occasionally, he used antiquated words, not pretentiously, not even consciously, but because they had become part of his vocabulary.
"Clarify. Night soil,"
Paxton said.
"Shit,"
Perry replied, which was pretty much what Pax thought he'd meant. Like most small to medium-sized settlements in this blighted country, the town was in some respects medieval. No sewage system, no septic tanks, no indoor plumbing, except in a few cases a hand pump in the kitchen sink tapping a private well. There would be an open-air communal latrine just beyond the last buildings, basically ditches and a series of baffles, where people relieved themselves or to which they carried their products. It would be situated to ensure that the prevailing winds more often than not carried the stink away from the town, which meant in this case to the south and west. Perhaps the personal hygiene standards of Abdullah al-Ghazali forbade the dumping of their waste in a far corner of the backyard. More likely, they periodically disposed of it in the communal latrine because the stench it produced and the cloud of flies it drew would identify their hideout as surely as if they had raised over the house one of their black and red flags. Into his phone, Pax said,
"One bucket for men, 1 for women.
"Honorable modesty,"
Perry agreed, and he terminated the call. Short of knocking on Abdullah's door and pretending to be from the Census Bureau, they weren't going to get any better confirmation that all 7 terrorists were in the house. The buckets were superb intel. In the deep shadows, just inside the doorway of the building that faced the terrorists' haven, Paxton and Danny began quietly to set up the Carl Gustav M4 recoilless rifle, an anti-tank weapon that was also effective as a bunker buster.
Chapter 38. Give Death a Kiss. Bibi was wired. Not on Chardonnay. Wired on the weirdness of it all. Cranked up by a feeling of impending violence. Like the air pressure before the first lightning flash of a storm so strong that it might spawn the mother of all tornadoes. Apparently, some weird guy lurked in the parking lot, obsessing over the meaning of the vanity plates on Nancy's sedan. And evidently, a nameless presence stalked the kitchen, because the smell of rotting roses had become a stink, because the candle flames were undulating 3 or 4 inches above the lips of the cups that contained them, and because the room had suddenly grown chilly. The wall clock and her wristwatch had stopped, their sweep hands no longer wiping away the seconds, and the digital clock on the microwave had gone dark, as if something that lived outside of time had stepped into this world and brought its clockless ambiance with it. Perhaps the psychic wave detectors, aka the wrong people, whoever or whatever they might be, were already on their way to Bibi's apartment to beat her to death or suck her blood or steal her soul. Whatever the hell they did to those cretins who were foolish enough to think that a little divination session over the kitchen table would be harmless, gosh, perhaps even fun. 24 hours earlier, Bibi wouldn't have taken any of this seriously. For she had been a highly efficient, driven autodidact who had taught herself at least 2 college degrees worth of knowledge, a level-headed realist who enjoyed fantasizing, yes, but who always knew precisely where the borderline was between the real world and false interpretations of it. She'd had a keen eye for the too bright, too fuzzy worlds of idealists, and for the too dark, too complicated versions of reality concocted by paranoids. Now, the borders seemed to have been erased, or at least blurred, and for the first time in her life, she felt that among things a modern woman needed, a gun was no less essential than a smartphone. "I need a gun," she declared. And though the words sounded alien to her nature, she knew that she spoke the truth. Kalida's pistol lay on the table, but she pulled it closer to her, beyond Bibi's reach, as if she didn't rule out the possibility that her client meant to shoot her, the messenger. "I don't need yours. I have one," Bibi said. Paxton insisted on it. "But I keep it in a box in the closet." When Bibi started to get up from her chair, Kalida said sharply, "Sit down. We have to finish this, and quickly." With her right hand, the diviner stirred the loose tiles in the silver bowl. "I bleed for answers. I cannot be denied. Attend me." The air grew chillier. To Bibi, she said, "The name of the person you're meant to save. How many letters?"
"I don't know."
"You do know. You just don't know you know. How many letters?" Bibi guessed. 10?
After Kalida plucked the tiles from the bowl, she placed them side by side in alphabetical order. A, B, E, E, H, L, 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 S, Y. Seeing names in that mess was harder than seeing words, but after a moment, the diviner spelled out Sally Beale.
"Know anyone with that name?"
"No."
"It isn't necessarily someone you know."
Kalida rearranged the tiles into Shelley Abel. "This is ridiculous," Bibi said. But she couldn't deny the room had gone so cold that her breath and the diviner's smoked from them. As before, Bibi suddenly saw what Kalida did not, moved the tiles around and formed the name Ashley Bell. As she slid the last 2 letters into place, she heard the silver bell with the 3 tiny clappers that Captain had brought back from Vietnam. And although their ringing was clear and sweet and undeniable, she knew that she heard them only in memory. As if Kalida were a curious cat and Bibi were a ball of string in need of unraveling to reveal the wild secret at its center, the diviner watched her client intently, waiting for the best moment to snatch up a frayed end and run.
"The name is familiar to you."
Bibi shook her head. "No.
I can see it is.
No. But I'll admit it resonates.
Resonates?
The diviner said, wanting something more specific. It's so euphonic. It makes you want to know the person who goes by it, to see if she's as pleasant as her name.
She or he. It could be either.
It's a she, Bibi said with immediate conviction.
How can you be so sure?
Bibi frowned. I don't know. I just am.
You not only have to find her, you have to save her.
As Bibi stared at the name, it had half drawn her into a trance, as though each of the 10 letters must be a syllable in a sorcerer's spell. Now she shivered and looked up at the diviner and said, save her from what? Should you ask and draw more letters?
No, we're running out of time. We've been too long at this.
Bibi realized that warmth had returned to the kitchen and that the clocks were working once more, as was her wristwatch. I need to know why she's in trouble, or will be, where she lives, what she looks like. I have 1,000 questions. A mule as thin as a paper cut escaped Kalida as she extricated the needle from her flesh. She pressed her bleeding thumb against the blood-stained cotton cloth.
We only get so many answers for free. And then they begin to cost us dearly, word by word. Now peel off a few 3-inch strips of that adhesive tape for me.
Producing the first strip with a dispenser's built-in cutter, Bibi said, cost us what? Hurriedly winding the gauze around and around her thumb, keeping it tight to stanch the bleeding, Kalida said,
time. Our allotted time. Days, then weeks, then months. Our lives melting away fast from the farther end. And then we pay with something worse.
What could be worse than losing part of your life?
Losing the capacity for passion and hope. Being left alive, but with no emotions other than bitterness and despair.
She held out her thumb so that Bibi could apply the length of tape.
No additional answers we might get would be worth the cost.
The roses in the living room smelled sweet again. The flames had stopped leaping violently above the rims of the clear glass cups. The fluttering reflections of candlelight on the tabletop and the walls no longer reminded her of swarming insects. The air of impending violence should have diminished. It hadn't. While the diviner hastily used 3 more strips of tape to encase the gauze, Bibi came further to her senses, much as the once cold room had returned to warmth. I can't do this. Glancing at the clock, displeased by the time, Kalida said,
can't do what?
Save a life, whoever she is, wherever she is. It's crazy on the face of it.
Of course you can do it, the kind of girl you are. Besides, you have no choice now.
I might end up doing more harm than good. I'm planning to marry a hero, but I'm not one myself. I mean, I don't think I'm a coward, but I don't have the skills. Pouring the Scrabble tiles from the bowl into the flannel sack, returning the sack and the bowl to the ostrich skin suitcase, Kalida said,
you asked why you were spared from cancer. You were told. If you're not prepared to do it now, there's a terrible price to pay.
More harm than good, Bibi repeated. It could end up with this bell woman dead. And me too. Getting to her feet, closing the suitcase, Kalida said,
you've already been on a date with death and survived. If he shows up again, kiss him and tell him he has to wait. Make it a good kiss. Put some tongue in it. Now grab your gun, girlfriend, and let's get the hell out of here.
What? No. Bibi yawned and stretched. I'm exhausted. I'm going to bed. Kalida regarded her as if she had just announced that she would lie down in a cauldron of boiling oil.
If you stay here 10 more minutes, you're dead. Maybe 5.
But this is my apartment.
Not anymore. Not after what we just did here. which drew their attention. Now the apartment is theirs, and no lock will keep them out.
Chapter 39. Love Call and War Cry. Assuming that Abdullah al-Ghazali and his associates were heavily armed and ready to die a martyr's death, it would be suicide to blow down the door and fight the seven of them room by room. And seven would be the number, because the women would not be bystanders. If Intel had their identities right, these two mothers, mothers in more than one sense of the word, had with enthusiasm provided four of their young children for service as human bombs. This spec op was the science fiction movie equivalent of a bug hunt, for which the sole hope of success would be the ruthless application of maximum force. The Carl Gustav M4 recoilless rifle weighed 15 pounds, four less than the M3, and had an overall length of 37 inches. The ammunition was heavy, but considering the nature of all possible targets in the ghost town, none of which could be defined as a true bunker, merely above-ground buildings often of dubious construction, they had chosen to bring only four rounds. To compensate for this extra weight, which would complicate an overland trek, they carried less ammo for their rifles and pared their gear down where possible. Two men were required to operate the weapon, one to fire it and the other to load. Paxton would fire and Danny would load. And they agreed to launch not from the doorway of the abandoned house, but from a long ago shattered front window. Some guys called the Carl Gustav the Carl Johnson, a surname used as slang for the male sex organ, and others called it the Goose. But whatever its name, the launcher was more effective than Thor's hammer, with a range of more than 1,300 meters. Abdullah's current residence stood little more than 20 feet away. A blowback of debris would be significant. Firing over the windowsill from a kneeling position, they could duck their heads after launch and hope that most of the trash flung in their direction would rattle harmlessly off the walls that surrounded the window opening. After they both put on double ear protection, Danny arranged the four rounds on the floor, under the window. Kneeling, Pax shouldered the Gustav. Danny opened the Venturi lock, a handle that moved the hinged breech to one side for loading, and inserted the first round. The roof of the two-story building across the street from the rear of Abdullah's rat hole provided a high mud brick parapet with cutouts fitted with widely spaced iron bars, an ideal setup for a sniper. Perry and Gibb lay at different crenellations, watching the back of the house and the street. In the quiet of the morning, the empty buckets, swinging from their handles, squeaked as the murderer returned from the community latrine. He let himself through the rear gate and crossed the yard, a rectangle of cracked and littered concrete. Someone had been watching for him. The door opened. He went inside. Perry called the one number programmed into his satellite phone, and when the connection was made, he said,
"Everyone's safe at home."
Given the short range to target, Pax didn't need either the 3x optical sight or the fitted iron sights. The impact explosion at once rocked the morning, while blowback junk rattled, pocked, pinged against the front wall of their house and whistled through the window over their heads simultaneously, or so it seemed, with the blast. There were the smells of concrete dust and hot gases from the Gustav, and Danny sneezed as he opened the Venturi lock to load the second round. A Carl Gustav round could slam through steel-reinforced concrete as if through cheese, and the overpressure from the explosion tended to screw up most of a building's interior. From their roof position across the street, Perry and Gibb weren't able to see what happened to the front of the house, but the entire structure quaked and swayed and deformed, and two exterior shutters on the back windows blew off, clanging against the concrete yard as spikes of window glass bounced and splintered on the pavement. At most 20 seconds after the building was slammed, the back door flew open and two men staggered out, disoriented and no doubt half dead. The Night Soil manager drew the pistol from his drop-leg holster, and the new guy carried a fully automatic carbine with an extended magazine, maybe an Uzi. Gib needed one shot to take out the would-be Scarface, a second to ensure the kill, and Perry dropped the other terrorist, sparing him from further latrine duty. Following the second round from the Gustav, the house resembled a set from a Transformers movie after a robot had stomped through it. Pax was prepared to use the remaining two rounds, and Danny loaded one. But the building swayed as though constructed of pudding and crashed in upon itself, clouds of dust billowing into the street. They tore off their ear protection, snatched up the MK-12s, ventured outside as the air slowly cleared. Approaching the target house, they were cautious, though the chance of anyone within having survived seemed nil. Perry and Gib came in from the street to the east, which was when Pax learned that two had been sniped, leaving five under the rubble. Time now to call in the carrier-based helo to extract the team, though the task remaining wouldn't be easy. The point was to prove you couldn't kill 317 Americans and live long enough to brag about it to your grandchildren. They needed to find Al-Ghazali, photograph his face or what remained of it, and take a tissue sample for DNA. Otherwise, some anonymous, internet-savvy bonehead would fake proof that he was Al-Ghazali, and 31% of Americans would believe him. Pax started to call for the helo when Bibi's face bloomed so vividly in his mind's eye that the ruins of the ghost town ceased to exist for a moment. If previously he'd suspected she was in trouble, he knew it now. This was battleground intuition on steroids, and more than intuition. He had to wrap the op, ditch this cesspool country, and call Bibi as soon as the blackout rule no longer applied, when they were at sea, aboard the aircraft carrier. Chapter 40. Downhill, over the edge, into chaos. Kalida Butterfly was a whirlpool, a vortex of dark energy that couldn't be resisted, so that Bibi was caught up in the woman's fear, felt it swirling through her. So convincing was the diviner's anxiety, so distraught the series of expressions that tortured her face, it proved impossible quite to believe that she could be a fraud with criminal intent. And there had been too many bizarre occurrences to dismiss her as a delusional paranoid. Something extraordinary was happening, about to happen, approaching fast, and the prudent course seemed to be to get out of its way before it arrived. In the bedroom closet, as Bibi opened the shoebox and retrieved the holster with the Sig Sauer P226, Kalida said, "I'll leave my massage table. It'll slow me down. I'll get it later, next week, whenever. Can you hurry, kid? Come on, come on." Bibi shrugged into the shoulder rig, adjusted it, pulled a blazer off a hanger and slipped into it. The pistol already held a full magazine. She glanced at herself in the closet door mirror. The gun didn't show under the coat. Her reflection didn't quite resemble the one to which she was accustomed. Hair kind of wild, windblown on a night without wind. Strangeness swimming in the dark pools of her eyes, hard edges in her face that she hadn't seen before. She thought she looked like a desperado, or a perfect idiot. In the living room, as Kalida snatched up her suitcase, Bibi grabbed her purse and laptop. "Damn it. Why did Mom and Dad sic you on me?" "Not their fault. They couldn't know. Nothing like this ever happened when I did them." "Nothing like what?" "The disgusting rotten smell. The cold from nowhere. The weird candle crap. The clocks. The wrong people coming." Following the woman to the front door, Bibi said, "I figured stuff like that always happened."
"Never happened to me before."
"Never?" Bibi pulled shut the door. She fumbled with the key to engage the deadbolt. "But you're the diviner, the big kahuna." Hastening along the balcony toward the stairs, Kalida said, "It happened to my mother sometimes. She warned me about it. But maybe I didn't take her seriously enough." "Wait up." Bibi hurried after the blonde. "Didn't take her seriously?
Really? I mean, really? Your mother, who was tortured and dismembered?
No need for the snarky tone, kid. Sometimes you can be pretty damn insensitive.
The long-legged Scrabblemancer bounded down the stairs two at a time, her footfalls hammering reverberant groans from the ironwork. In vanilla white slacks and top, flamboyant sash and scarf, multiple hoop earrings, and a glittering trove of finger rings, she might have been a glamorous fugitive from a 1950s movie comedy about a Las Vegas showgirl on the run from the mob. Nimble and agile, Bibi plummeted after her, risking a bad fall, but proving, if there had been any doubt, the symptoms of gliomatosis cerebri were gone without a trace.
Hey, you know, sometimes you can be damn frustrating.
Better than snarky.
I wasn't snarky.
Ear of the beholder,
Kalida said, as she came off the last flight of stairs and made her way between the row of sun loungers and the glimmering pool, where the trout-swift young man had earlier been swimming laps. Sprinting to close the gap between them, Bibi reached with her left hand and snared the expensive-looking gold star on blue field silk scarf that trailed behind Kalida, hoping to use it to ransom a few answers from the panicked diviner. The exquisite scarf wasn't merely wrapped around the woman's throat, however, but was instead loosely knotted, which called before the court the laws of physics, in particular those that dealt with motion, action, and reaction. With a choking sound, Kalida Butterfly abruptly ceased forward motion and dropped her ostrich skin suitcase to clutch at the strangling silk, simultaneously staggering backward two steps and colliding with Bibi, whose forward speed was at that instant decisively checked. For a moment, they wheeled around each other like the gimbal mountings of a gyroscope. But though one of the functions of a gyroscope was to maintain equilibrium, they weren't able to maintain theirs. They teetered together on the pool coping, a mere degree of tilt away from a wet plunge. When Bibi thought to let go of the scarf, the forces of nature, which had been cunningly engineered to make amusing fools of human beings in most circumstances, at once rebalanced themselves, thereby casting both women off balance. Kalida fell to her knees on the pavement, while Bibi tottered backward and dropped hard into a sitting position on one of the sun loungers. The Amazon diviner had progressed from fear and anger to terror and rage. She acted on the latter as she thrust to her feet, cursing Bibi and the Thorpe children that she hadn't yet produced.
Get away from me! Stay away from me, you insane, crazy bitch!
As Kalida turned toward her dropped suitcase, Bibi said, Crazy bitch! Me! 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 I was just having the best day of my life, that's all. Free of cancer! Then you show up and... But she abandoned that line of response. She loathed the whine in her voice. She did not want to paint herself as a victim. Valiant girls did not whine. They never played the victim, even if there were benefits to be had from inhabiting that role, which there were, huge benefits, which was why everyone wanted to be a victim these days. Half of Kalida's custom-crafted two-sided suitcase had fallen open when she dropped it, spilling the silver bowl and some of the other items that she used for divination. She stooped to repack with urgency. Bibi rose from the lounge chair. Look, maybe I am crazy. Running from my apartment because you say someone's coming, someone or something. I don't even know who or what or why. Crazy for buying into this Ashley Bell thing. But here I am. So tell me how to find her. Tell me who these wrong people are. Turning to face her, suitcase in hand, Kalida said bleakly,
Oh, you'll know them.
Because the apartment complex catered to young professionals, most of them single, thought had been given even to the lighting in the courtyard. In the service of romance, or whatever the hippest of the cool called it these days, the tall bronze lamps and every fixture used in the landscape lighting produced a calculated radiance, a candescence, resplendence, that flattered every face, that buttered an appealing sheen of health on the skin of every limb and curve that might be revealed. In this well-schemed, computed, designed light, Kalida remained as pale as bleached flour. Oppressed by fear, she had a face that appeared sliced bread flat, incapable of offering any expression other than dread.
You'll know them when you see them.
What are we going to do? Bibi asked.
We aren't doing anything. I don't want to be anywhere near you. Not now, not ever. What I'm going to do is run. Run and hide.
With that, she turned away and hurried toward the parking lot, all of her bejeweled and silk-scarfed glamour gone. Now just one more desperate woman, overwhelmed by the madness of the world. Chapter 41. 6 years earlier. The warrior Olaf and his Valkyrie. For 6 happy years, the foundling Olaf had been an exemplary companion. As pure of heart, as noble, as joyful, as loving as any dog who had ever lived. He had walked out of the rain to become his beloved girl's best friend, and he had kept faithfully at her side through every mood and circumstance, taking to the sea and surfboard as enthusiastically as she did. When he first showed symptoms, the cancer had already spread from his spleen to his liver and heart. Dr. John Kerman called it hemangiosarcoma. Although Bibi was a lover of language, that was a word she would hate for the rest of her life. As if it weren't merely a word, but also one of the names of evil. Neither chemo nor radiation would extend the dog's life. The veterinarian estimated that Olaf had a week, at most 2 weeks, to live. Bibi gave her cherished friend all the affection that could be squeezed into so little time, fed him all of his favorite treats and some that he'd never tasted before. She took him on easy walks, not where she determined, but where he seemed to want to go. They sat on the bench at Inspiration Point for hours, watching the sea in all its serenity and all its tossing glory, while she shared with the golden retriever every confidence, as always she had. Her mother and father weren't surprised by Bibi's devotion, but they didn't expect that her commitment to Olaf's comfort in his last days would extend to participation in the act of euthanasia. The moment might arrive when the cancer, thus far largely painless, would begin to work its agony in the flesh. With human beings, a natural death was a death with dignity. But animals were innocents, and as their stewards, people owed them mercy. Bibi decided not only that Olaf must not suffer, but also that he must not be in the least afraid when the moment came to put him down. The dog liked his vet, but he didn't like needles and became anxious at the sight of them. Only his trusted mistress, so precious to him, might inject him without causing him so much as a moment of fear. Dr. John Kerman was a good man, extending every kindness and courtesy to people and animals alike, but he didn't at first think it wise to grant young Bibi's request to administer the mortal drugs herself. Although mature for her age, she was nevertheless only 16. Soon, however, she convinced him that she was up to the task, both emotionally and intellectually. During that week, each time he had a dog to be anesthetized for teeth cleaning or other procedures, Dr. Kerman welcomed the girl into his surgery to observe how a catheter was placed in a leg vein. She also attended 2 emergency euthanasia sessions, observing solemnly, and wept only later at home. Using green grapes and hypodermic syringes, she practiced the carefully angled insertion of a needle. On the morning of the 10th day after they had been given Olaf's prognosis, the dog came to a crisis, suffering a sudden weakness in his legs. His breathing became labored, and he began whimpering in distress. John Kerman arrived at the bungalow with his medical kit, confirmed that the moment had come, and on the nightstand in Bibi's bedroom, he placed the instruments that she would need. Murph called Olaf to the bed, and for a few minutes, they left the girl alone with the retriever, that she might look into his eyes and whisper endearments to him, and promise him that they would meet again one day in a world without death. When BB was ready, the vet returned to stand to one side and watch, prepared to intervene if the girl lost her courage or if she appeared to be about to make a mistake of procedure. Nancy and Murph got onto the bed with Olaf to hold and stroke and reassure him. The dog exhibited none of his usual fear at the sight of the needles, but watched his mistress's hands with interest. They were delicate but strong and steady hands. Once the catheter had been placed in the femoral artery of the left rear leg and taped in place, Bibi inserted the needle in an ampoule of sedative and expertly drew the required dose. Through the catheter port, she slowly administered the injection. Dr. Kerman's preferred two-step technique wasn't to put the dog down in a sudden hard fall, but first to bring on sleep in a gentle fashion. As the barbiturate flowed from the barrel of the syringe into the vein, Bibi looked into Olaf's eyes and watched as they clouded with weariness and fluttered shut to enjoy his last rest. When the dog was deeply asleep and certain not to feel even the barest moment of panic when his cardiac muscles stuttered, Bibi used the second needle to inject the drug that stopped his noble heart. On the drive to the pet cemetery with her mom and dad, Bibi sat in the back seat, holding the blanket-wrapped body of Olaf in her lap. The PowerPack 2 cremation system was housed in a garage-like building behind the pet cemetery offices. Usually, if the family wished to wait during the cremation, they did so in the visitor's lounge in the front building. After watching Olaf's body be placed alone in the cremator, Bibi insisted his ashes must not be mingled with those of other animals. Nancy and Murph preferred to wait in the lounge, where there were magazines, a television, and coffee. Bibi remained in the back building, perched on a chair in one corner, watching the hulking cremator, sitting witness to her companion's voyage through fire. More than 2 hours later, when the ashes were presented to her in a small urn, the bronze was warm in her cupped hands. The Vikings believed that fallen warriors were conveyed to Valhalla by beautiful maidens known as Valkyries. On the bench at Inspiration Point, on beach walks and elsewhere, Bibi sometimes had explained to Olaf that the world was a battleground, that in a sense, every man and woman was a warrior, which was part of Captain's philosophy that he shared with her in the years before Olaf had come along. Everyone struggled. Everyone fought the good fight, or raised arms against those who fought it. "You're a warrior too," she said, and the retriever always looked at her as though with understanding. "Dogs try to do what's right, most of them, anyway. And dogs suffer. They're tormented and starved and abused by people unworthy of them. Who knows what you endured before you found me, my furry warrior." That afternoon, leaving the crematorium, she was Olaf's Valkyrie, although she couldn't take him to Valhalla, only home to the bungalow and to her bedroom, where she holed up for 3 awful days, felled by grief, unable to talk to anyone, not even to her mom and dad. In the meeting with Nancy and Murph, when he had delivered the news of Bibi's brain cancer, Dr. Sanjay Chandra had wanted to know what kind of girl Bibi was, her psychology and personality, so that he could determine how best to share with her the diagnosis. Murph had said,
"Bibi is an exceptional girl. She's smart. She'll know if you're putting even the slightest shine on the truth. She'll want to hear it blunt and plain. She's tougher than she looks."
When those words had not adequately conveyed the kind of girl she was, Olaf's euthanasia was the story that Murph had then shared with the physician. Chapter 42. The Book of Leaping Panther and Gazelle. Bibi watched Kalida Butterfly fleeing the courtyard until the woman disappeared into the parking lot and the night. Amped on adrenaline, apprehension, and the mystery of all things, Bibi glanced at her wristwatch. 10:04. Looking up at the third floor balcony, she thought of her bed. Under the currents of energizing fright and amazement that kept her mind spinning, she felt a deep weariness that, given a chance, would surge up and overwhelm. The unfinished wine in the bottle of Chardonnay might be just the key to open the door to dreamland. Would she really be at risk in that cozy haven, where she had for years locked out the world and all its temptations, all its frustrations, to create worlds of her own? Kalida said yes, said run, said hide. But the name Kalida wasn't a synonym for truth. When Bibi had left the apartment, the roses had been as beautiful and fragrant as when she'd first come home, not rotting as she thought they were while she'd been mesmerized by Kalida at the kitchen table. Here, in the fresh air and normalcy of the California night, she could half convince herself that nothing of the recent events had been as strange as it had seemed at the time. Half convinced wasn't convinced enough. Heart still beating too fast, too hard, she picked up the purse that she dropped when she collided with the diviner, slung it over her left shoulder. Carrying her laptop in her right hand, she started toward the parking lot. An object lying in a fan of trembling palm frond shadows and lamplight caught her attention. She scooped up a small hardcover book that must have fallen out of Kalida's suitcase with the other divination gear. Bound in high-quality tan cloth, the volume featured two inlaid, stylized Art Deco figures, crafted of intricately stained and engraved leather. They were depicted back-to-back, in profile, a panther leaping toward the spine, a gazelle leaping toward the right. There was neither a title nor an author's name. From nearby came the deep, hoarse, trumpeting cry of a great blue heron, startling Bibi. She surveyed the sky, certain she had heard the bird's flight call low overhead. Except for a distant police helicopter thumping through the cool night, nothing plied the heavens. A bird the size of the heron, 4 feet tall with a 6-foot wingspan, couldn't be overlooked in motion. When the cry came again, louder and more protracted than before, it seemed to be not a common expression out of nature, but from out of time. A mystical alarm meant to shake her awake from her indecision. Hoping to be gone before the wrong people showed up, she ran out of the courtyard and into the parking lot. Chapter 43. 6 years earlier. 3 days in a locked room. The story that Murphy had told Dr. Sanjay Chandra ended with the cremation of Olaf and with Bibi's retreat into her bedroom, where she remained for 3 days alone with the urn that contained the dog's ashes. This seemed to be the natural endpoint of the tale, but there was another scene known only to the girl. Perhaps it didn't qualify as a fully developed scene, only as a coda. No one but Bibi could know the extent and complexity of it. In any other family, a 16-year-old girl wouldn't have been able to sequester herself in her locked bedroom for 3 full days, feeding on a supply of apples, cheese and peanut butter crackers, and dry roasted almonds. When her parents were asleep, she ventured out to snatch sodas and bottled water from the refrigerator. She refused to respond to questions addressed to her through the door, though after the first few hours, her parents granted her the consideration of silence. Her mother and father had always loved her deeply and without reservation, had always wanted the best for her, but their love had not been twined with expectations. They hadn't given her guidance regarding anything more than the rules of the household. Never had they suggested that any endeavor or aspiration was better than anything else she might be doing or wish to achieve. Their politics, to the extent that they had any, were libertarian, and their love for their daughter grew in a libertarian garden. If their attitudes in this matter had been different, the family might have been a place of unceasing argument and tension, for even by the time that Bibi was 6 or 7, she had ideas about some subjects that were different from her parents' positions on those issues. Often in her childhood, relatives and others had commented on her quiet nature and reserve, by which they intended to imply that she seemed shy, or worse than shy, aloof. Had observed that she was unusually assured and self-reliant for her age, by which they meant that she struck them as being peculiar and suspicious. Had noted always with well-meant concern that she took everything perhaps too seriously, that she engaged in every activity, whether reading books or surfing or competitive skateboarding or learning to play the clarinet, with a disturbing intensity, by which they wished to warn that she had the potential for obsessive-compulsive disorder, and had remarked in a tone of praise characterized by uneasiness that she might be some kind of genius or prodigy, or at least gifted, by which they avoided saying that they found her a bit weird. Nancy and Murphy understood that, in one sense at least, an alien lived with them, an otherworldly but benign creature who loved them but didn't understand key things about them, such as the it'll-be-what-it'll-be doctrine that stood central to their creed. And they were cool with their daughter's difference. Therefore, with the urn containing Olaf's ashes always near at hand, Bibi spent 3 days in solitude, though she was never lonely and certainly not bored. At her small corner desk in her armchair, and often sitting up in bed, she wept with grief and wrote for hours at a stretch. Sometimes she made entries in her spiral-bound diary, at other times composed fiction in a large lined yellow tablet, her meticulous cursive script never faltering, regardless of the length of those sessions. Frequently in the past, she had written while in a condition of infatuation, with ideas, with language, with storytelling, when, for an hour or two at a time, she had neither the desire nor the will to look up from the page. Alone with Olaf's ashes, this infatuation was shot through with desperation, energized despair, as never before. Her primary motivation during those 3 days was to argue herself out of some bad ideas, one in particular, compared to which mere suicide would have been preferable. She exhausted herself with writing, so that it seemed when she crashed, she should have had no imagination left to craft stories in her sleep. But her dreams swelled with wild adventure, threat, and mystery. She dreamed repeatedly, but not exclusively, of the tall and monkish figures in a variety of settings and scenarios. When those menacing phantasms turned toward her, she erupted from the nightmare every time, certain that she would have died in her sleep if she had glimpsed more than the pale moonlit suggestion of their horrific faces. On the third day, she remembered a trick of forgetting that the captain taught her. In more than one war, Captain had seen things. The bloody aftermath of human viciousness, outrages from the darkest end of the spectrum of cruelty, that disturbed his sleep night after night, that left him despondent. He couldn't bear to live with the memories. The trick of forgetting had been revealed to him by a gypsy or a Vietnamese shaman or by an Iraqi version of a voodooist. The captain couldn't remember the identity of his benefactor, no doubt because for some good reason he had used the magic procedure to forget that person too. Anyway, what you needed to do first was write the hated memory or the reckless desire or the evil intention on a slip of paper. The trick worked for more than the disposal of garbage memories. Then you said 6 words that had great power. Said them with sincerity, with all your heart. After you had spoken that incantation, you put the slip of paper in an ashtray or a bowl, and you set it afire. Or you scissored the paper into tiny pieces and flushed them down a toilet, or buried them in a graveyard. If you recited those magic words with humility, and if you were entirely truthful with yourself when you claimed to want forgetfulness, you would receive it. Bibi forgot. Not forever, as it turned out, but for years, she forgot the bad idea that she had written on the slip of paper. The thing she had wanted to do, had almost done, that would have ruined her life. Her sharp grief remained, but her fear was lifted from her with the memory. She slept without dreams that night, and on the following day, returned to family life. That was the third time that she had used the captain's method of forgetting. She, as yet, had no memory of the first and second. Chapter 44. Adjusting to Paranoia. In the lot behind the apartments, the parked vehicles and the thick posts supporting the roofs of the open-air carports provided cover for anyone who might have bad intentions. At the very least, Bibi expected the guy who brooded over the meaning of vanity license plates. She walked directly to her Ford Explorer, which was parked beside Nancy's BMW. Step by step, she surveyed the night for a suspicious malingerer, ready to drop the laptop and draw the pistol from her shoulder rig to warn him off. She reached her SUV without being assaulted, and in the driver's seat, at once locked the doors. She felt foolish for wondering if the Explorer would explode when she switched on the engine, and of course, it did not. Whatever real-life drama she had been thrown into, it thus far had been free of mafia movie cliches. Just as she pulled out of the lot and turned left, headlights flared behind her, glaring off her rearview mirror. A sedan followed her into the street. When she turned right at the first intersection, so did the other vehicle. After two more turns, she had no doubt that she was being tailed. Might this be one of them? One of the mysterious wrong people? She wondered, capitalizing the term for the first time. No. Common sense argued that adversaries with paranormal abilities